Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry.
Hello, and welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussion. I'm your host, Brother Adam Thayer. This is episode number 293. Up first, we have a piece regarding the Tyler, titled Tyler's Operative and Speculative by Brother P.J. Adrian. Various dictionaries indicate that the spelling Tyler, with a Y, is simply an older form of the more modern Tyler, with an I. Freemasonry, with its leaning towards antiquity, has merely adopted the older spelling. The word tile is derived from the Latin tigula, and became an Old English tigule. The word heel, as used in our obligations, is derived from the word heelan in Old English, with the meaning to cover, and led to the common use of the word hellier, for a tradesman who thatched with reeds, heeled with tiles, or daubed with plaster to cover in a dwelling or other building. In London Ordinances of 1832, we find the word tiler with a Y. From the Bristol Ordinances of 1450, tiler with a Y, and in 1475, tiler with an I. Workers at the St. Mary Redcliffe Church between 1509 and 1534 were described as tilers. In 1753, a list of London companies contained that of the Tylers, and this is spelled with the O-U. The early Tylers. The more permanent building materials, such as bricks and tiles, were introduced by the Romans during their occupation of Britain, but after their departure, the ancient Britons went back to building with wood and covering with thatch or straw. The population grew, houses were built closer together, and the inevitable happened. After a number of devastating fires in 1077, and again in 1087 and 1161 in London, and many more in other towns and villages, a London ordinance was issued in 1212, requiring that in the future no roofs be covered with the inflammable material such as straw and reeds, but only with tiles, lead, shingles, or plastered straw. This was obviously a great boost for the tiler's trade, which was further enhanced when in 1362 an uncommonly heavy storm flattened many houses throughout Britain and unroofed many more. The tiler's profiteering was quickly stopped by a royal order prohibiting the tilers from charging more for their labor and materials than they had done before the disaster. They were not to charge more than 6 pence per day for their labor, and not more than 7 shillings per 1,000 plain tiles. A mere 20 years later, on the 10th of May, 1382, another proclamation settled the wages of a tiler at 12 pence per day, a rate of inflation of 100% in 20 years, which is one that we have not had the luxury of for many years. It is not certain when the Guild of Operative Tilers was formed, but it is likely to have been in the period around 1212, when tiles and slate were used in preference to straw and reeds. In 1461, another ordinance decreed that the tilers of this city shall henceforth be reputed as laborers, and shall not be incorporated nor deemed to constitute an art or society. In 1468, however, the tilers requested that the fellowship of the craft of tilers be reinstated, as indeed they were, and their status as an incorporated society was redeemed. The Tilers Guild continued for many years, and much of their activity is recorded. One of the last was at the coronation of Queen Victoria on the 28th of June, 1838. 4 Masonic lodges, all members wearing regalia, took part in a procession. They were followed by various trade guild representatives, amongst which were the tilers and the stonemasons, each man with an emblematic apron. The tilers' place in Freemasonry. Skilled workers have guarded their trade secrets through the centuries, and the use of a member of their own group as a sentry to keep out intruders was an established custom in medieval times. That they were not always successful is evident, and industrial espionage is today almost a respected occupation. These sentries are referred to in various Masonic documents as outer guards, junior entered apprentices, doorkeepers, garters, and janitors. After the word tiler first appeared in print, these various other titles continued in use for many years thereafter. So when did the word first appear in print? Dr. Anderson, in describing the formation of the first Grand Lodge in 1717 and the second Book of Constitutions, which was issued in 1738, wrote, Sayer, Grand Master, commanded that the masters and wardens of the lodge to meet the grand officers every quarter in communication at the place he should appoint in a summons sent by the tiler. So there it is. But why was it not in the first edition of the Book of Constitutions, which was issued in 1723? There is no record that indicates that Dr. Anderson took part in or even attended the 1717 formation of Grand Lodge, and it is therefore likely that the good doctor quotes Grandmaster Sayer from notes taken by someone else. It might well be that the title had come into use subsequent to the formation of Grand Lodge, and that Dr. Anderson, in recording an event that took place 21 years earlier, might well have used the word in current use rather than the actual word used by our first Grand Master. We shall never know. And the bylaws of a lodge, probably written towards the end of 1732, appear 16 rules, the ninth one of which reads that the master or secretary do give notice by letter to all members of the time of election or any other emergency that at any time shall happen. Also, that the tiler do require from every brother, as soon as the lodge is closed, his apron. Also, that the tiler admit no visitor into the lodge room, except there be some present who can vouch for his being a regular brother. We've already seen that the word was not used in the first edition of the Book of Constitution. In Old Regulation 23, we read, "Another brother, who must be a fellow craft, should be appointed to look after the door of the Grand Lodge, but shall be no member of it." The same regulation in the 1738 second edition reads, "Another brother and master mason should be appointed tiler to look after the door, but he must be no member of the Grand Lodge." In the same second edition is this interesting paragraph. "In ancient times, the master, wardens, and fellows on St. John's Day meet, either in a monastery or on the top of the highest hill near them, by peep of day, and having there chosen their new grand officers, they descended, walking in due form, to the place of the feast, either a monastery or the house of an eminent mason, or some large house of entertainment, as they thought best tiled." Before dismissing Dr. Anderson as having misquoted our first Grand Master, it needs to be remembered that the second Grand Master, George Payne, elected in 1718, was a member of the committee formed to issue the third edition of the Book of Constitutions, that the relevant paragraph was the same in that edition, and that George Payne was present at the formation of Grand Lodge. But how good was his memory for words actually used in 1717 when the third edition came out in 1756, nearly 40 years later? The tiler's sword. The trowel, now seen as a working tool or symbol, was used differently in the early days of masonry. From the minutes of a lodge in Carmarthen, we learn that they paid for 5 trowels and mending 12 others. From some versions of the old catechism, we learn that the junior entered apprentice was armed with a sharp instrument, which was a pointed trowel. Bernard Jones suggests that the sentence in the charge after initiation, that in every age monarchs themselves have been promoters of the art, have not thought it derogatory to their dignity to exchange the scepter for the trowel, refers to the practice of the most recent initiate, the junior entered apprentice being armed with the trowel as the means of keeping out all cowens and intruders. So the earlier use of the trowel may have been transferred to the sword, the tiler's dress. First impressions being considered as very important, tilers in days gone by were decked out in colorful clothes. The Grand Tiler in 1736 wore a red waistcoat under a dark blue coat trimmed with gold lace. A tiler's coat in the possession of the Eaton Lodge number 533 EC is of black serge, lined, faced, and edged with red, while the collar, cape, and cuffs are edged with light blue flannel. How proud they must have been, these tilers of old, dressed in their blue and red coats with yellow trousers and cocked hats, going around delivering the notice papers to all the brethren. Everyone must have known them as being Freemasons. There was no secrecy about being a Freemason. They walked in processions in all the regalia, carrying their swords. A beautiful illustration of the wearing of regalia in public is the well-known painting of Brother Hogarth Knight. Thomas Jefferson, who was Grand Tiler in 1784, had a business card which had various Masonic emblems on the front, as well as his name, and that he was Tiler to the Honorable Society of Free and Accepted Masons. On the reverse, it stated where he lived, and where letters or messages for him could be left, which he undertook to duly answer. The tiler's duties of old. Unlike the tiler of today, who keeps off all cowens and intruders and sees that the candidates are properly prepared, the tiler of old had in many lodges the job of drawing the lodge, the delivery of the summonses, now better known as the notice paper, and was also often in charge of the various assets of the lodge. The drawing of the lodge stems from the days when the speculative masons were meeting in taverns. The rooms available in those inns were usually pretty sparsely furnished and with bare floorboards. On a clear space in front of the master's pedestal, the tiler would draw with chalk and charcoal a rectangle, and therein various Masonic emblems, such as the pillars, the tessellated pavement, the working tools, and many others. The tiler was also paid for the delivery of the summonses. In the second half of the 18th century, the delivery of a note in an envelope by the postal service would cost 4 pence, where the tiler was usually paid about 12 pence for delivering all the summonses, so obviously a good money saver for the lodge. Tilers today. Bernard Jones, in his Freemason's Guide and Compendium, writes, "The officer responsible for the preparation of the candidate is the tiler, who should be an experienced craftsman well able to ensure, both by his knowledge and personality, that the candidate enters upon his preparation in the right spirit. Although today the preparation is usually done by a steward or one of the deacons, it is still the tiler's job to actually see that the preparation is properly carried out." And as noted earlier, the tiler is also responsible for ensuring that each brother will enter the lodge room properly clothed, and to admit only properly vouched for brethren. The written history of tilers does not go beyond 1732, but from various lodge minutes and reports we have been able to form a reasonably good picture of the duties of tilers and how they appear to the outside world. No more important injunction can be given the tiler than the advice of Brother Bernard Jones, who wrote that the tiler should be an experienced craftsman, well able to ensure that the candidate enter upon his preparations in the right spirit. All right, I hope you enjoyed that piece. I've been thinking a lot about our tilers lately and how underappreciated they are in many of our lodges. So next time you see your tiler, shake his hand and tell him thanks. Up next, we have an article titled "The Rite of Discalciation." It was from a Short Talk Bulletin, Volume 11, April 1933. Author unknown. A candidate for initiation into a Masonic lodge often finds odd those requirements which he must fulfill in order to do as have all good brothers and fellows who have gone this way before. Indeed, that preparation often remains a puzzle to him, since the ritualistic explanation is only partial. Not only does the newly made brother, bewildered by the new world into which he is thrust, investigate further to ascertain if all was told him which might have been, to learn a still further meaning to the ceremony and symbol which the passage in Ruth purports to make plain. Those who read the fourth chapter of the Immortal Book of Ruth will note especially the seventh and eighth verses. "Now this was the manner in former times in Israel, concerning redeeming and concerning changing. For to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor. And this was a testimony in Israel. Therefore the kinsman said unto Boaz, Buy it for thee. So he drew off his shoe." Redeeming here means the taking back or recovery of land or property pledged for a debt. Changing refers to the transfer of ownerships. As both were then, as now, matters of importance, it is evident that the plucking off of the shoe as a pledge of honor and fair dealing was of equal importance, comparable with our swearing to our signatures to documents before a notary public. Note that to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe, not his shoes. Taking off one and handing it to him with whom a covenant was made was a symbol of sincerity. Removing both shoes signified quite another thought. These are separate and distinct symbols. In Freemasonry, both are used, and it is wise to distinguish between the two, not to miss the beautiful implications of entering that place which is holy with both feet bare. The rite of discalciation, from the Latin discalciatus, meaning unshod, is worldwide. Freemasonry's ritual of the entered apprentice degree refers to the passage in Ruth. In the master's degree, the reference is not verbal, but an act which differs in meaning from that in the first degree. In all probability, Freemasonry takes this symbol from other sources than the Old Testament. Obviously, any system of teaching which is the result of coming together of 1,000 faiths, philosophies, rites, religions, guilds, and associations must have received so common a symbol from more than one source, although the Great Light does contain it all. In the Old Testament are several passages which make removal of shoes quite a different gesture than that described in the passage from Ruth. Exodus chapter 3 verse 5 states, "Draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground." In Joshua chapter 5 verse 15 we find, "And the captain of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, Loose thy shoe from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy." Ecclesiastes chapter 5 verse 1 reads, "Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God." The association of the removal of footwear when treading holy ground is a fairly obvious symbol. Sandals or other footgear were used to protect not the ground, but the feet, both from injury and from filth. To wear such protections in holy places, by inference stating that the holy place was harmful to the feet or was dirty. It is similar in thought content to the worldwide custom of men removing the hat in church. The knight removed his helmet in the presence of those he did not fear. He was safe in church. The removal of his protection against a blow was his acknowledgement that in a sanctuary not even an enemy would assail him. We know the custom was widespread, not confined to Israel, from many sources. Thus, Pythagoras instructed his disciple to offer sacrifices with their shoes off. In all the Eastern religious edifices, the worshipper removed his shoes in order not to defile the temple with that which touches the profane earth. Maimonides, expounder of ancient Jewish law, says, "It is not lawful for a man to come into the mountain of God's home with his shoes on his feet, or with his staff, or in his working garments, or with dust on his feet." The custom was found in Ethiopia, ancient Peru, the England of the Druids. Adam Clark thought the custom was so general in the nations of antiquity that he quoted it as one of the 13 proofs that the whole human race descended from one family. The rite of discalciation becomes the more beautiful as we progress through the degrees. At first, it is only a voluntary testimony of sincere and truthful intentions. Later, it is an act of humility, signifying that he who removes his shoes knows that he enters that which must not be defiled by anything unworthy. The word humility must be strictly construed that it be not confused with its derivative, humiliation. He who is humble but acknowledges supremacy in another or the greatness of a power or principle. He who is humiliated is made to feel unworthy, not in reverence to that which is greater than he, but for the personal aggrandizement of the humiliator. A man removes his hat upon entering a home, in the presence of women, or in a church, not as a symbol of humility, but of reverence. The worshipper removes his shoes on entering a holy place for the same reason. He who walks neither barefoot nor shod offers mute testimony, even though as yet uninstructed, he knows it not, that he is sincere. He walks with both feet bare. He who walks with both feet bare signifies that he treads upon that which is hallowed. Freemasonry does not stress in words this meaning of the rite of discalciation for good reasons. Throughout our system, the explanation of our rites concerns always the simplest aspects. The fathers of our ritual were far too wise in the ways of the hearts of men to teach the abstruse first and go then to the East. Rather did they begin with that which is elementary. Then, very often, our ritual leaves the initiate to search further for himself, if he will. It is Freemasonry's recognition that man values most that for which he has to labor. But it is the less stressed meaning of the rite which is of the greater importance. He is the better Freemason and the happier who digs for himself in the rubbish of the temple to uncover that which is gloriously buried there. Is proof necessary that behind the tiled doors of any open lodge is a holy place? Here it is. Freemasons teach that the great light is dedicated to God as the inestimable gift of God to men for the rule and guide of his faith. In the great light we read, "For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them." Every Masonic lodge is opened and closed in the name of God. According to his promise, therefore, no lodge meets without the great architect being in the midst of them. Consequently, the lodge is holy ground. This being so, it may well be asked why all Freemasons don't remove their shoes when entering lodge. Once a Freemason, always a Freemason. No lodge member is required to repeat the obligations he once assumed on every occasion at which he is present when a degree is being conferred, because it is well understood that the obligation is binding upon him for life. Every time he follows the old words in his mind, he re-obligates himself. Whenever he sees a candidate initiated, consciously or unconsciously, he himself is again initiated. Having once been taught that a candidate is prepared in a certain way because of a certain meaning in that preparation, it is unnecessary to inconvenience him every time he comes to lodge. If he is again so prepared in his heart, he fulfills all the outward requirements. While the promise and the fulfillment make the lodge holy ground, it is kept holy only if those who form it and conduct it so revere it. Stonemasons erect a temple to God, ministers dedicate it, and worshippers consecrate it. But a desecrating hand, as in war, may unroof it, use it as a stable, or make of it a shambles. Mackey beautifully put the thought of the consecrated holiness of a lodge. The rite of discalciation is a symbol of reverence. It signifies, in the language of symbols, that the spot which is about to be approached in this humble and reverential manner is consecrated to some holy purpose. Of all the degrees of Freemasonry, the third degree is the most important and sublime. The solemn lessons which it teaches, the sacred scene which it represents, and the impressive ceremonies with which it is conducted are all calculated to inspire the mind with feelings of awe and reverence. Into the Holy of Holies of the temple, when the Ark of the Covenant having been deposited in its appropriate place, and the Shekinah were hovering above it, the high priest alone, and on only one day in the whole year, was permitted, after the most careful purification, to enter with bare feet and to pronounce with fearful veneration the Tetragrammaton, or Omnific Word. And into the Master Mason's Lodge, this Holy of Holies of the Masonic Temple, where the solemn truths of death and immortality are inculcated, the aspirant on entering should purify his heart from every contamination, and remember with a due sense of their symbolic application those words that once broke upon the astonished ear of the old patriarch, "Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground." Holiness is not a thing, but an idea. So far as we know, the beasts of the field reverence no place as holy, for they have no consciousness of God. The sacred words of the great light are holy to us for what they teach and mean, because of whence they came. The paper, the leather, and the ink which form a Bible are no more holy than the same materials formed into a telephone directory. The stones of which a church is built, the wood from which the pulpit is carved, the metal from which the cross is made, are only the familiar stones, trees, and minerals used by men for 1,000 purposes. Cotton and dye which form the stars and stripes are but the fruit of plants. Book, temple, and flag are holy to us because of our reverence for the ideas for which they stand. They are holy to us because we make them holy, keep them holy, think of them as holy, and cherish them as holy. So must it be with our lodges. What is a lodge? A certain number of brethren, a charter or warrant, the three great lights, and an underlying idea, a faith, a belief, a mystic tie never seen of men, but the stronger for its intangibility. To many, the lodge is the room in the temple in which brethren meet. Walls of stone or wood or plaster, floor of carpet or linoleum, some seats, an altar, and yet by common consent of all who believe in the power of the Spirit which consecrates when the lodge is formed, holy because of what it means. The worshipper in Eastern lands removes his shoes before he enters his temple as a symbol that he knows his flesh needs no protection from that which it will there touch. A symbol that he brings not within its precincts any filth which might defile it, the Master Mason, symbolically removing his shoes before entering his lodge, knows that here he will find the holiness which is in the promise of God unto David, the holiness of the book on the altar, the very presence of the great architect, through whom the lodge receives the greatest of his blessings to man, friendship. But also does he symbolically remove his shoes that he may carry nothing of mineral or metallic nature, remember earth is a mineral, into the lodge to defile it. Men can, and some do, defile their lodge. He who brings in evil or contentious thoughts of his brethren defiles it. In more than one jurisdiction in the world, the brethren are asked at every meeting if there be any not at peace with their brethren. If such there are, they are required to retire and return not until their differences are reconciled, literally carrying out the instructions. Therefore, if thou bringest thy gifts to the altar, and thou rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come offer thy gift. The Mason who comes to the lodge to get something from it, rather than give something to it, may defile it by that selfish attitude. Men get from Freemasonry by giving. He who brings pride of place and power to his lodge serves only for the empty honor of title or jewel, defiles that which is holy as surely as did those money changers whom the great teacher drove from the temple. He who assumes to work in his lodge but labors carelessly in a slovenly manner to the desecration of ceremonies ancient when his ancestors were not yet born, defiles his lodge by his tacit assumptions that his convenience is of greater importance than the teachings of Freemasonry. Alas, that so many symbolically wear shoes in the holy place, by the simple process of thinking little of it, regarding it but as a club or association of men who meet together to pass the time away. Such brethren may indeed have been entered, passed, and raised, but uninspired, uninterested, and unhelped, they leave, seldom or never to return. To such as these, the lodge cannot be holy. Therefore, charitable thought would argue that their failures cannot defile. Luckily for us all, the majority of Freemasons who are constant attendants at lodge, the brethren who do the work, carry the load, attend to the charity, form the committees, put on the degrees, go on foot and out of their way to help, aid, and assist. The brethren, in other words, who work for and are content with a master's wages, these do keep the lodge holy. These do think of the three great lights upon the altar as the sanctum sanctorum. These do indeed put off the shoes from off their feet in humble and thankful knowledge that the place in which they stand is holy ground. Okay, that's all for this week. Be sure to stop by the website at wcypodcast.com and pick up a couple of pins. If you happen to see me out and about, stop me and ask me for one. I always have a few extras to share with a brother. Brother Robert will be back next week. Until then, stay on the level.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Be sure to join us for our next edition.